Hello, welcome to Firestarter, the UK's first podcast for social enterprise and health. This is episode 3 and is the continuing presentation from Stan Fekiakara. If you haven't heard part 1, this probably won't make much sense, so go back and listen to part 1 now. And now I'll hand you over to Stan.
One of the things that this entire lovely edifice that we had created over 15 years, all built on the fact of changing the economic base of the community and giving them an independent source of income, was threatened in 1991 when the government of India decided to go down the route of structural adjustment under pressure from the IMF and World Bank and global and open up its economy, liberalization. And I love these words, liberalization, free market and all that. I love the way that they make it all sound very noble, it's free market. I always wonder, free for whom? What do you mean by free? Free as freedom or free beer? Free in what sense? But there are all these lovely words, the free market and liberalization and so on. But under these things, and the guise of these things, which was really nothing more than allowing the free flow of capital into the Indian economy, which until 1991 was a protected economy, and forcing us to open our gates to Western capital, because there was a surplus of capital in Western economies, and allowing them to invest. And so you had all these people with their tongues hanging out, not at all unlike the private sector who was sitting in that meeting, because they are just seeing an opportunity to make money. All of them coming in to India, we realized that local rural economies are going to change. Because what you are going to get is a vacuum kind of economy, which would suck up resources from the lowest level. And that's the power of capital. And sure, true enough, all our fears, unfortunately, came true when by the end of the 90s, the tea prices collapsed. Up until then, tea was the darling of the Indian government and the Indian economy because it was a huge foreign exchange earner. So it was always protected. And we were aware of it and we were piggybacking on that. But in 91, with foreign direct investment coming in after opening up the economy, tea became unimportant to the government of India and to the national economy because there were much easier ways of bringing in foreign capital and foreign reserves. And so our foreign exchange reserves are booming. We have enough and more to pay off all our debts. And so we don't have to protect any particular economy or industry. And so as a result of it, tea was subject to market forces and the price of tea started collapsing. To give you an idea, in the early 90s, in the mid-90s, the price of green leaf, which the farmer produces, had gone up to 18 rupees for a kilogram, stabilized at an average of about 14, 15 rupees a kilogram of green leaf. By 1999, this had dropped to below, it had come all the way down to 3 rupees a kilogram and stabilized at an average of about 6 rupees a kilogram, half or one-third of the price, with the input costs actually having gone up. And so this took the entire bottom out of the economy for these people. Their entire livelihood was threatened. And in the past, if a landlord did not pay a proper wage to the tribals, we could mobilize 200, 300 people, go catch this guy by the collar and demand that he pay a just wage. And there was not a problem for us to do it. And we have done it time and time again. But when tea prices crash and we say, who has done this? We are told it's market forces. And where are these, who is this market force? Where does he live? Where do we go and protest? Whose collar do we catch? Do we go to Delhi? Do we go to Geneva? Do we go to Brussels? Do we go to New York? Do we go to London? Do we go to Paris? Where do we go and protest? And it's not that there have not been protests. The whole of India has been protesting against this because it's not just happened to tea, it's happened to cotton. More than 1,200 farmers have committed suicide last year, cotton farmers, because of the collapse in the prices of cotton. And so on one hand, people are dying for purely economic reasons. And on the other hand, we talk about providing healthcare. They're not able. So when we talk about suicides, priority suicide, we say it's a mental health problem. And let's come up with a mental health solution. But these people are committing suicides, drinking the very poison that they got into debt buying to spray on their crops. This is the irony of it. They get into debt, borrowing money from banks to buy pesticides to spray on the cotton, and then they drink the pesticides because they cannot pay off their debts. 1,200 farmers last year committed suicide in different parts of the country. And this is happening all over. And there have been protests to no avail, because the government, whose job it is to protect the poor, puts up their arms and says, these are market forces, we can't do anything about it. And so we are caught up in this situation, and we realized we predicted this in 91, and so we started looking for alternatives. We said we have to find an alternative, because you can't just uproot the tea plants and plant something else now. And it's true of any crop. And that's when we came across fair trade. And we were so excited, because we said, wow, this is it. This is our solution. So all we are going to do is find these nice guys out there, and this was in Germany that we first came across them, find these lovely Germans who will pay us 15% more for our tea, and our problem is solved. And so it was a fabulous love at first sight. Marriage took place immediately. We had a fabulous honeymoon. We sent off, you know, 20 tons of tea to Germany. And it was, you know, they talked about this fabulous project. We talked about this fabulous partnership and everything like that. But very quickly, we realized the limitations of fair trade. And I know this has now become a sacred cow. You know, it's to say that you have any criticism of fair trade is, you have to be, you know, you must be very right-wing to say that. Let me say that while I will raise some criticism and shortcomings of fair trade, let me say I am a great admirer of it, and I believe that this, for its time, did something wonderful. But this was a solution and an answer a few years ago. I don't think it is an answer today. And we need to move on. We need to push those boundaries. We need to go beyond what we understand by fair trade today. Our problem with fair trade was manifold. One was a very simple one. They could only consume or sell a very, very small fraction of what we produced. We produce about 400 tons of tea a year. They could buy 20 tons. So even if they gave us 15% premium and we had divided it over these 400 tons, it amounts to nothing. So it does not really make a difference to our community. The second problem with, and a more serious problem with fair trade that I had at a more kind of theoretical level, was the fact that it didn't change the system. All that it did now was move me from an exploitative Western capitalist to a benevolent Western capitalist. Here I sold my tea to a chap who'd screw me and try to get it at the cheapest possible price. Now I'm selling it to a nice guy who pays me 15% more. But the power still remains with the person who is buying my tea. And the moment I sell my tea, I've lost control over it. I don't know what happens to it in the market. I know where it goes. A little bit, yeah, it goes to some of these shops. And there have been a lot of attempts with the fair trade thing to connect the producer and the consumer with each other. And it is in one of these attempts to connect us that we discovered another problem with tea, with the fair trade, was when a group of our tribals came to Germany. And they went around to in the 90s, when these were, you know, fair trade was still not a word that was commonly used. They talked about these as one world shops in Germany, which are usually run by volunteers in the back of a church or in somebody's garage and things that usually, you know, the back of somewhere, a vague place. So you had to be in that inner circle to know where it was. And these are very hardcore committed solidarity movement types who would bicycle and walk great distances to the shop to buy this tea and drink it. And when we would go down from, you know, we went after one meeting and another, various of the One World shops, things like that. And after one of the meetings, Bowman, who was the secretary of the AMS, and one of our tribal leaders, we were walking back and he said, Stan, there's something here I haven't figured out. I haven't got my head around it. I think this is a wonderful experience. They're such lovely people. But these people are buying our tea, not so much because they like it, but because they feel solidarity with us. So I said, yeah. That's the driving force that, you know, they want to help and the other stuff. He says, that means these people are our friends. I said, yeah, that's it. You know, they're all people who subscribe to our values and they think alike and they are trying to help us and they come from this. He says, but they are paying more for the tea. I said, yeah, that's how this whole system works. They pay 15% more and that's passed on to us. And that's it. He says, that's not fair. These people are our friends. They should pay less for our tea, not more. We should take more from the other people, not from them. These are our friends. And Bowman, in his very insightful way, introduced something into trade which the market has very successfully kept out, and that is the role of human relationships in trade. What the market has successfully done is to take humans out of it, take people out of it, out of the products, and keep the two ends of the spectrum of trade, the producer and the consumer, as far apart as possible, so that capital can do its business. And when the work that we are doing now is, we always ask people, you know, when I go to sell my tea in the market, who do you think decides the price? Do I as a seller decide it, or does the buyer decide it? Obviously, it's the buyer. I have no say in the price. You know, these are market forces. The market decides the price. The buyer decides the price. But when you go to Sainsbury's or Tesco's or any other place here and go to buy tea, who decides the price? Do you decide, or does the seller decide the price? The seller decides the price, and not only that, they put it on a barcode, so you can't even bargain. You know, there's a barcode out there to tell you what the price is. So there's nobody you can't even bargain with the person at the till, because even that person doesn't know. If you ask her what's the price on this, you know, all set for, let me see if I can negotiate something on it. All she does is puts a machine and then it rings up on the computer and it says, this is the price. And there's nothing more you can say. You just fork out the money. But why should this happen? The trade is actually, it's two, the same action. There's a buyer and there's a seller. But at one end of the market spectrum, the buyer decides the price. At the other end of the market spectrum, the seller decides the price. And the actual trade is between me and you. I produce the tea, you're going to drink it. And we have been made totally powerless within the so-called market space. And I'm raising this because I think this operates in every economic activity. And it'll be interesting for you all at some point to look at how this operates within healthcare. Who actually decides the prices? If you want to know anything about the big thing that stands out and leaps to my mind now is the whole war on the prices of retroviral medicines, where it was being sold for $12,000. I still remember when I heard that figure, that it was sold for $12,000 for a year, supply of retroviral medicines. And Cipla was offering it at, some $100. I was sure that $12,000 was a mistake. It must have been $1,200. It couldn't be that much. But it was actually $12,000 worth thing. That was the difference. So if you look at this, I think we need, we'll look at it in health also, how that market actually operates. Because we are talking about an industry here. We are talking about about a market here. And we need to see how it operates. So what we decided was, the time has come for us to take control of the market as well. Just as we took control of the land, we took control of our health, we took control of our education, we'll now take control of our market. And this we decided to do, and this was done by recognizing that actually we are the market. The so-called market force is not a market force. That is the force of capital. It's a force of capital that decides prices. The market force is you and me. It's you drinking my tea and me producing the tea. Together we are a force. But because we are kept apart, we are powerless. And therefore, capital then becomes the market force. They determine the market. But actually, we could connect. We could become the market and we could become a force. And so we set up Just Change, which started as a concept, which has now become an organization, which is working in primarily in India. But we have Just Change UK. We have Just Change Germany, and we have now Just Change Belgium is just forming. The concept behind Just Change is to link producers and consumers. And this started, the idea really began when in 94, my wife and I were invited to come to UK to look at poverty in UK from a southern perspective. So this is a very interesting reversal of the Raj. You know, we've always had white people coming and telling us what's wrong with us, why we are poor and what we need to fix it. So it was quite an interesting reversal that we were coming here to tell you what is wrong with your and what you needed to do to fix it. Look at that. So in that trip where we spent a month, we went to various council estates in the UK, including Easter House in Glasgow and what was then a very, very rundown council estate, Mosside in Hume, which is, I went there last year and found it very smartened up, couldn't recognize it at all. But in that trip, we found in all these council estates that we visited, people drinking large amounts of tea. You know, in India, we drink tea in cups which are half this size. And here, people drink them in big mugs. And we drink them maybe, one cup in the morning and one in the evening, at about 4 o'clock. And here, they drink these big mugs right through the day. You go and say, put the kettle on, wherever you go in, Polly, put the kettle on. I mean, that's, for the first time, I realized where that nursery rhyme came from, being taught by nuns. But that this was a way of life, you know, that people drank large amounts of tea. And we discovered they're paying a hell of a lot for that tea. And when we talked to them in 94 about fair trade, none of them had heard about fair trade. Subsequent visits, many of them had heard of fair trade. And we said, you know, what about buying fair trade? And they said, that's not for us. That's for the posh. That's for the people who are posh. Because this notion of putting 15% more on a product immediately takes it out as an option for the poor. No matter how much they may want to, it is not an option for them. And so we said that, you know, going back to what Bowman said, these people are our friends. These, the people living on council estates here, the unemployed, people on benefits, people who are struggling, are our natural allies. They are people who are suffering the way we are. They should be drinking our tea and they should be able to afford it. And we should not be pricing it out of the market for them. And so we said, what happens if we could link these two groups and ensure that our tea comes here? This has led to the setting up of the Just Change India Producer Company, which is now a company with 40,000 families from four groups in India who are member shareholding members. And we have started our own shops in our villages, village shops, where we source products first from within the members of that particular group, then products, if it's not a product produced by that group, from one of the other members of the Just Change company. And if it's not available there, we try to source it from other producer groups who may not be members, but who are organizations of farmers and producers. And only if it's not available there, we source it from the open market, because we're not able to. We've just started. We actually started serious trading only 2.5 years ago. And but it's already having a major impact. In the UK, we struggled, to be honest, because what I thought were community organizations here, because we use the same, and this is the trouble with language, you know, you use the same words, but they mean very different things. You talk about community organizations here, we talk about community organizations in India, they're two completely different animals. As far as a community organization is a membership-based organization, like I said, the AMS has 2,600 families, which means that these 2,600 families meet every month. They meet in different fora, at the village level, at a district level, all of them together. There are all kinds of meetings. And for me to get a message out to 2,600 people is not a problem at all. I'll do it within 30, give me 13 days, 30 days, and I'll get any message across to these 2,600 families at no extra cost. But here, a community organization would actually mean a handful of people, often self-selected, representing the community. And they do not have the kind of influence over the community that our elected representatives in our community organizations have. And so we thought this was very simple. You know, you just send tea to a community organization and they'll go and tell all their members, listen, you know, this tea comes from India, it comes from these people, the Adivasis who are growing it, and they are trying to change the system. Let's drink this tea as long as you like it. And it'll be sold. It didn't work. We struggled. But what did happen was that smaller groups, especially ethical retail cooperatives, like Unicorn in Manchester, Out of This World in Newcastle, Eighth Day also in Manchester, a couple of others, about six of them, started buying our tea. And it was very interesting when we started, and especially with Unicorn, and they were saying, what's the price of your tea? I said, you tell me. I said, no, you have to tell me. You're the seller. You should tell me the price. I said, no, you tell me what, you know, you can pay. I'll tell you what it cost for us to bring the tea here. But when I talk about a cost, the first cost that I attribute is the living wage for the person who produced it. It's only after that I'll add the processing charges, the tea bagging charges, the packing, the transport, the shipping, bringing it to your shelf. So that cost includes a living wage for the people. So if you paid me that cost, we're still happy. But you decide what your customers are willing to pay for it. And I even suggested, why don't you do one thing? Why don't you just put the tea bag on the shelf and tell your customers to pay what they think they want for it? And the reaction that I got when I floated this idea to many people here in Britain was, you know, the British would be too embarrassed to do that. You know, we'll be, not because we wouldn't want to, but just be too embarrassed to take that decision. You know, we prefer it to be decided by somebody else. And I'm more recently suggested Unicorn a slightly different idea, which they still haven't taken up. It's too radical for them. I said, okay, if they are so embarrassed about, and Unicorn had another problem. It's not just the embarrassment of their clients or their customers. It's also the system. Because, as I said earlier, you know, it's a barcode. And their whole accounting system is dependent on that red laser light going in there and reading it. And it's, yeah. They said, our accounting system would go haywire if every bag of tea had a different price on it. And how do you put a barcode that has different prices? How do we do this? So I've come up with an idea that saying that, why don't you just put up a board there, like how you have, your reel of plastic bags or gloves that you can pull out when you have to take vegetables. You have a thing there which gives you a different choice of barcodes, a different range. This barcode is £1 to one, is £1.25. These barcodes are £1.50. These barcodes are £1. So you take, no embarrassment here. You just take off whichever barcode you want, stick it in your pack, and take it to the till and pay for it. It's still too radical for people to let consumers decide what they should pay for it. But this is about shifting power. This is about allowing the consumer to decide what they want to pay over and above what was the production cost. Because actually, at 55p for a bag of 40 tea bags, we have covered all costs, including a living wage. Anything above that is profit. And in the normal market system, this profit would belong to the investor of capital. What we are coming up with Just Change is the idea that capital, the investor of capital, the investor, the producer, and the consumer work together as a cooperative. And this, I am told by people who know more, won't work because there is conflict of interest. They say, how can you have a, you can have a cooperative of producers, you can have a cooperative of consumers, you can have a cooperative of investors, like a bank or an investor company or whatever. But how can you possibly have a cooperative of all three, because these are conflicting interests? The capital, the investor wants to get as much money out of it as he can, the producer wants to get as much money as he can out of it, and the consumer wants it as low as possible. But a cooperative way of working is about negotiating and taking a decision that is in the best interest of all. And I believe that we are conned into believing that there is a conflict of interest. I don't believe that there is a conflict of interest, because if we realize that all our futures are interdependent, you as a consumer cannot continue living your life if I as a producer am not secure. And a person with surplus capital cannot continue unless we are still producing and we are still consuming. And so it is actually in our interest to make the system work. And so we can negotiate. Let's talk about it and figure out a way by which we can all function as a cooperative. And so Just Change is really a cooperative of producers, consumers, and investors. And recently, just last year, we came across our first community group in Marsh Farm in Luton. Met them by accident at a New Economics Foundation meeting. And before we knew what happened, within a year, 1 ton of tea has been shipped to Marsh Farm. They've set up a community business, and they are going knocking at every door, asking their people to taste the tea, and if they like it, to buy it. And they ran a huge risk, and they didn't tell me about it, because, and I'm glad they didn't, because if they told me, I'd tell them not to run that risk as yet. They actually ran a huge risk and went for a tea tasting competition on BBC, a local radio, Three Counties Radio, where there was a blind tasting done, and the other competitors were Twinings, PG Tips, Morrison's something, Morrison's Gold, and one other one. There are four of them, and Just Change tea. And this was a real gamble. I mean, if they had been picked that this was rubbish, that was the end of it. And they said goodbye to Marsh Farm. We'll have to try and do something else. But believe it or not, we came up tops by four independent tasters. All four of them unanimously, in a blind tasting competition, picked this as the number one tea. And so the great thing is, unlike a lot of fair trade tea or any fair trade product, it tastes good. And we can take on Twinings, so we can take on PG Tips, which are the kind of teas that are drunk in these places. And we actually developed this tea for that market. In fact, when I sent some of the tea as a sample to the Fair Trade Foundation some time ago, they rejected it. And only after they rejected it, it suddenly occurred to me, that tea was not made for the normal fair trade buyers. We actually produced a tea which would be drunk by people on council estates and not for the more posh people, which need a lighter. These people need tea, They don't need hot water. They don't need colored hot water. They need good tea. So there's a little punch in our tea there. And so we actually produced it for that. We made a tea that would suit that and did not suit the fair trade market. So one, it tasted good. Secondly, the big issue was pricing. And this was a huge issue in Marsh Farm. Because we said, you decide. It's 55p to reach it to Marsh Farm. Now you decide. And so they decide to pitch it along with the other big blends. And where a pack of 40 fair trade tea bags would sell for £1.20 or £1.40, they are selling their tea at 75p for 40 tea bags. And they're moving it on their council estate. We also have a lot of volunteers in Britain, especially in London, who are moving this, and it's more moving the idea. Because the whole idea behind this is not about selling tea. It's about selling a new way of doing business. And I think there are lessons in this just change idea for everything that we do. We don't just have to look at it in products, but we can also look at it in services. How do we sell services in a way it is not controlled by the owners of capital? And is actually controlled by the people who are providing the service and by the people who need the service. And I think if you look at your healthcare system, we have a system by which the providers, as well as the people who use the service, are both equally powerless. I've heard friends of mine cribbing about the NHS, and I've heard people within the NHS also cribbing about the NHS. You know, doctors and everybody, things like that. But what's happening? Why is this happening? We have people, I personally know a number of doctors who really, and nurses who really want to provide quality care for their patients. Why is this a problem? So I think we need to look at it from that point of view. I'll end with a few concluding remarks so that we open up for discussion. One is, I'm going back to the earlier comment that I'm a person who always looking for alarm bells. I love alarm bells because that makes me stop and think, and also shakes our levels of comfort. And one of the alarm bells went off was when we said that both the Conservatives and the Labour parties welcoming social enterprise. I'm just saying it's just an alarm bell. It's that for us to think, why is this being welcomed? Why is social enterprise being welcomed? Is there a danger of us being co-opted, becoming part of the system, not challenging a system? And is this an acceptable face of privatization? Especially in a country like Britain, which has a strong history of the state providing healthcare, and not going down the American route. Is this slowly opening out that door to go down the American route of totally privatized healthcare? I have a sister in the US who's worked her whole life, retired from a fabulous job as the head of a lab, and had to go back working as a telemarketer after working at Harvard as a top-notch scientist, working as a telemarketer just so that her insurance could get paid for, because the insurance costs are so high. And I was trying to tell her, you come and invest in our tribal insurance, You can come to India, it'll afford you the money you give, you can come all the way to India and we'll take care of all your health needs and you can go back. You can get your dentistry done, you can get whatever you want done, And we'll throw in a few bonuses like, a whole facial free or an Ayurvedic massage free or whatever, and still be able to afford it. But one alarm bell, and that's what we need to keep care of, is I remember when Deva and Rupa first joined us and we started our health program, they were explaining about healthcare systems around the world and holding up the NHS as an example of one of the best healthcare systems in the world, where there was it was equitable, it was universal access, everybody could access it with some exceptions probably, and quality care. Now, why do we have a problem with, why did this become problematic? I don't know enough about what happened here. But I remember being told that, and Deva and all of them as community, having to study it as an example of probably the most closest to being a perfect healthcare system. So we need to spend some time, I think, looking at that. The second thing is, now I sound like a Blairite. You talk about joined up thinking. I hear the whole Blairite government and, in any document, policy document, that phrase comes on every other page. It's almost like reminds you of Siamese twins or something like that. They try to join everybody. But I think there is, apart from the jargon, there is a very important message, and that's why I told the story the way I told it, that to see health in isolation and healthcare in isolation will not work. We cannot see it in isolation. People do not live their lives in silos. Nobody in a community, whether it's rich or poor, Nobody says, this is my education life, and these are my problems around education. This is my health part of my life. When we provide services, we are in silos, and we think we are the beginning and the end of their world. So when a patient walks in through our door, and it comes to us, or when a student, when a mother or a father brings their child into the school to admit the child, you know, the professionals go, ah, you know, the other, because these are the high priests. You know, we are the high priests of these services, whether it's the legal service, whether it's an educational service, whether it's a health service. The high priests are very happy because they've got somebody entering into their fold and they are now in their power. You know, come into my parlor kind of thing. We got them. And then we see these people only within that context. We see these people within that particular context. And we try to deal with them in that very, very narrow context. And don't realize that their lives are much more than that illness. It's much more than that present condition. It's much more than just having to be admitted to school. There are a lot of factors that contribute to it. One of the classic examples we have from our own experience, whenever we have doctors who come to volunteer and work with us from outside. I remember a German doctor who came who was so shocked because she, when she came, she was very thrilled that, I don't know if you all are familiar with this, that you know, one of the very common things for diarrhea that we prescribe is what they call ORS, oral rehydration salts. And you get in packets from a company, you know, called Electral and all that, which are very expensive. And that's what they had been taught in their studies of tropical medicine. They had to prescribe ORS. And we have said, no. You know, all you have to do is say water with this measure of salt and this measure of sugar, boiled water, mix it up. It does the same thing that this big packet that costs a fortune does. And so she used to prescribe and say one spoon of salt or whatever, I forget the measurements, but one spoon of this and two spoons of sugar and so many measures of salt. And it never occurred to her that not a single tribal home has a spoon. And so she's prescribed something and it makes no sense to these people. You know, what? You know, how do I measure it? You know, how much is a spoon? It seems ridiculous, but it shows you, I'm using a very extreme example to show you how disconnected a professional can be from what is reality. Or we had another doctor coming and prescribing fruit. And say you need a lot more fruit in your diet. And says, you know, so said that, you know, buy a lot of apples. Now apples are great in Britain, but it is the most expensive fruit in India. You know, it just doesn't make sense to ask somebody to buy apples because nobody is going to buy apples. And it's very interesting that in India, this I find this fascinating. It is one of the most expensive fruits. And yet when somebody is ill, if you're visiting somebody in hospital, the first fruit you will buy is apples. Everybody buys apples and takes them to hospital. Because this is, again, from our whole colonial history, an apple a day keeps the doctor away kind of thing. People believe that apples are good for patients. They take apples. And they pay a fortune to take apples to people in hospital. It's very, very common. I mean, you'll see it all over. And you go to any, if you see a lot of apples being sold, just look around, there's a hospital close by. The two things always go together, apples and hospitals go together. So the point I'm trying to make is that we need to see people in their total context, their social context, their political context, their economic context. And unless we can see all these contexts and realize where the problem emanates from, we are not going to find a solution. We're just going to get costlier and more expensive healthcare, and we're still not going to solve the problem. We need to come up with a system where people are actually healthy. And so if all of y'all in the healthcare sector can start looking at creating a real healthcare system rather than an illness managing system, I think we have a better chance of actually bringing about true change. And we need to then see what are the impediments that prevent people from accessing or being able to live healthy lifestyles. I will end on one small, by describing, we don't have the time or the opportunity to play this game, but it's a game that I play in many of the training sessions that we have, and I will describe it. What we would do in a place like this, I would divide you and ask you all to go to two ends of the room and ask for four.
Why don't we do it?
We need a little bit of equipment. We need a couple of tools which might be a little difficult to do here. But I think it's fair enough to just describe it. I asked you to go to two ends of the room and ask for four volunteers from here, four volunteers from here. And the two groups of volunteers go up there. We send one of them out of the room and we tell the others that when this person comes back, this person is going to be blindfolded, gagged, hands tied, feet tied. And the other end of this room, we put some, you know, fruit or chocolate or something like that. And your task, without talking, you're not allowed to speak. Without talking, you're supposed to get this person to eat this fruit. So you're providing a service. You have to do it. If you were asked, given the task, what would you do? Just supposing you had to take a completely blindfolded person from that end of the room, who's at that end of the room, and get them to eat something at this end of the room, what would you do? How would you do it? Okay, that's one. Oh. Accompanying them.
Move the food from that end of the room to where they are.
Yeah, he's a smart guy. Yeah. You move the food to the other end of the room. Then what else? But remember, their legs are tied. So you take the hand, you'll have to take both the hands because both the hands are tied also. What did you do? Any other ideas? Exactly. I have played this game all over the world and I have never come across somebody who just unties them.
Yeah.
All you have to do is just untie them. And then let them decide if they want to eat it. They may not fall in love. You know, they might be diabetic like me and can't eat those chocolates. And you'll be stuffing chocolates down their thing. And then you'll have to go in and see that this person has got high. And then get some insulin. And, you know, and then you've got too much insulin. And then you're completely out of control. Just untie them. Just untie them. And I think when we are trying to provide services, we need to stop and think, what are the impediments? Before we start thinking of what are the solutions, let's look at what are the impediments that prevent people from implementing their own solutions. And I'd like to end by leaving you that challenge of what prevents people from living a healthy life. And I hope that we can all dream of a day when we will not need doctors and nurses. I know I'm sticking my neck out here in a room full of doctors and nurses to say something, but I'm sure many of you all will agree with me. I know it's an utopian idea, but at least where the demand for doctors and nurses do not have to be as severe as it is now. There will always be illness. I don't think we can ever dream of a world where there will not be illness. But can we minimize the need for illness management? And can we promote a system where people have the options to live healthy lifestyles? They can choose to be healthy. And we are able to remove the impediments that keep them from being healthy. I'll end with that, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you for listening. This was Firestarter, the UK's first podcast for social enterprises in health. And you can find more on our website at entrepreneurses.net. That's entrepreneurses.net. My name's been Dave Dawes, and the music's Fire Dance by DJ Booley through a Creative Commons license, which you can find out more on the website. Hope to see you next week. Bye.